Hey folks, welcome to a very, very unique episode of Long Shots. Obviously, we know that we are presently going through extraordinary circumstances due to the COVID-19 outbreak in India, globally, and a lot of things have changed in the last 2 to 3 weeks. And as you recall, we did 2 special edition episodes between our seasons, and then we were promising to come back with a new season with new equipment. But obviously things moved a fair bit since then, and we have all been working from home. But we thought it's important to voice our views and talk about all the different type of issues and concerns which people are looking at from a macroeconomic standpoint, from a financial standpoint. And first of all, we wish all of our listeners are keeping well. You, your families, you're staying safe. And we obviously are also working from home. And as a result, Sharad is here on the line with me, but he is speaking through the speakerphone. Hi, Sharad. How's it going, man?
It's going as well as possibly it can right now. Obviously, under lockdown with lots of things to worry about. But also, there's some time to get some work done, I guess. But life moves on, I guess, right? And hopefully, we just get over this as quickly as possible.
So you are not very amused by the fact that now the AQI in Delhi is at 40, and there's so much commentary going on Twitter how this is the way for nature to hit a reset button?
Yeah, that's pretty stupid. I find that pretty stupid. nature is what? Mother Nature fighting back and whatnot. Yeah. That's not how animal fights back.
Yeah.
It's a virus at the end of the day, and it's unfortunate. So, let's see. Everyone is in the. It's not a India phenomenon. It's a true, well and truly global phenomenon. And obviously, there's so many repercussions of it. And we are going to have a little bit of a bent on the economic and financial side, but obviously, that's not the most important here.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But to be fair, that entire nature reset argument, obviously, I kind of find it amusing. But yeah, these are times when you do get some perspective at the end of the day, right? Because you're kind of hitting the pause button on things. And I think one can be a bit contemplative and figure out where one stands with respect to broader scheme of things, because I think often everyone, like including me, including you, I'm sure, like we get so kind of intertwined with the day-to-day events and day-to-day ups and downs of life, something like this just shakes things up.
We're also testing our new equipment.
Yes, yes, we are. So this is the new, absolutely new podcast gear that we have. Obviously,
state of the art.
Obviously, I'm sounding much better than Sharad because I have the hardware with me in the same room. But yeah. I think Sharad, the voice that comes out of the phone with this gear is better than it would have if we had the older gear. So there's some bright side to look at.
Yeah, definitely an upgrade.
Yeah, definitely an upgrade. And it was, I think, last to last Tuesday since we have been working from home. But obviously, official lockdown kicked off this week in India on Tuesday, I think. Well, it's been so long, huh? And plenty of announcements have happened from an economic standpoint. The FM did a press conference, which started not on time as usual. And then...
why do they not start on time? Even all these central bankers are generally expected to start on time. It was pretty annoying.
Was the RBI press conference also a bit late? Oh, okay.
Yeah.
To be fair, a lot of things have happened. A lot of announcements have come. Markets were and still are extremely volatile because I think there's a simple reason, right? That risk can be priced, but uncertainty cannot. And that's where people are jumping ship and really reassessing their portfolios. And the FM and RBI governor's announcements this week were supposed to provide some comfort to businesses, to individuals, to the markets in general. What do you think, Sharad? What is your overall take on it? Are you happy with the way things have been on both fronts, or do you think there is more to be done and said at this stage?
Yeah, I think I'm broadly happy. The first things first, this was a staggered approach, right? It wasn't like in one shot, like everything came out. They phased it out. Like RBI took its time, took a day or two, and sort of there was industry chatter as well on, there needs to be some massive liquidity inflow and checks and balances put in, and they took their time. Is it enough? It's such a difficult question that you answer it in hindsight. But directionally speaking, like, I mean, at the end of the day, we all know that we are looking at a period of recession, global recession. I'll be surprised if we don't see massive slowdown in the near to medium term. And this is not like, the measures cannot be to increase demand. Like, I mean, we're in a lockdown and we will see like demand suffer, which is like sort of the economic engine on which everything runs. I mean, this is just to remove or manage stress in the system, right? And with the focus on the lending markets, credit markets. So I'm fairly comfortable with, you know, the kind of liquidity that's been injected in and, you know, through the various instruments. And I'm also happy with the massive rate cut. So there is definitely an intent there. I'm generally happy, like, in what it's been done. And it, obviously, more is better. I mean, when it comes to the finance minister's initiative, people can argue that there's a percentage of GDP, so less than 2%, you know, like the Western economies are doing much more. So, I mean, there is always that argument, but there are different sets of balances. There's different concerns that India has. You can't do a like-for-like comparison. And overall, I mean, looking at all these other things and sort of, I'm also a little bit of an optimist. So, I mean, a declining oil price might even actually reduce some stress. But let's see. Yeah. But largely, I'm happy that they've acted and RBI's decision across the board was pretty meaningful. It was heavy stuff. So,
and I think a lot of it was preempted, right? Which was good. I mean, yeah. I mean, I sometimes feel that there's a lot of comparison being done to Western democracies, but there the disease and its spread was at a fairly advanced stage when, you know, the ECB intervened or when the Federal Reserve intervened. In India, I mean, there were like around 500 active cases. Now, I mean, we can discuss how testing or lack of testing plays a role in that number being small. But here, I think especially the RBI governor, I think he preempted a lot of stuff, which I was quite happy about. On the FM side, obviously, as you said, you know, you can always discuss and, you know, deconstruct whether the number, you know, can be bigger or smaller. But I mean, I felt that when it comes to an overarching vision, the RBI was definitely ahead of the FM. Was that by design or not? I don't know.
Definitely. Yeah, no, definitely. I agree with you. Like, it was much more meaningful. It was much more targeted. It was much more specific. It was nuanced in terms of, you know, just basic things like how, you know, even things like how they're trying to emphasize on the credit markets. Like, I saw that there's a massive focus on the credit markets, right, to preserve the lending. And for me, like, that, it's quite meaningful.
Yeah, I mean, it's like a very well-known kind of maxim, right? That when it comes to credit, in times of a recession, it's not like the cost of credit goes up. It's just that liquidity disappears.
Dries up, yeah.
And as a result, I think the TLTRO announcement, which kind of focuses on a long-term financing, as well as the marginal standing facility announcement, which kind of, you know, covers short-term financing, that was pretty solid. And obviously, you know, the cash reserve ratio, which has been reduced. So cash reserve ratio is essentially what banks have to park with the RBI. So that ratio has been reduced substantially. And what I liked was that, you know, the liquidity, I would say injections, if they are made into, like the RBI specifically kind of went to the distance and said that these liquidity relaxations should be deployed specifically in commercial bonds and commercial paper, right?
Yeah, and investment grade corporate bonds.
Exactly. That there was an indirect kind of, I would say, backstop or support to those. Because, I mean, the commercial paper market was going haywire, right? I mean, we were seeing top grade NBFCs, even their commercial paper, the yields were spiking. And because, I mean, they basically represent overnight lending, correct? And the yields being spiking, meaning that obviously the commercial paper was being sold aggressively. And now that kind of creates multiple problems. One is that the holders of the commercial paper, in this case, mostly debt mutual funds, will get losses on their books. So their NAVs would take a hit. But on the other end, for any lender or corporate to actually raise liquidity via issuance of commercial paper would become more expensive as well. So that, I think, for me was pretty significant on the, at least on the credit market side. What was your view on the moratorium, both on the work? I mean, I'm pretty sure on the working cap financing side, I probably know what your thoughts are. But, you know, the moratorium on all term loans, which obviously include retail.
Yeah, no, listen, I mean, that is, again, something that was widely expected. There was industry demand from it. There was retail demand as well in terms of easing the norms for it. So, for me, that was probably one of the most easy to call ahead of it. Like, I would have expected that to happen. I would have been actually fairly surprised if there was no relaxation on sort of interest payments or on the debt side for retailers as well. It is required at this time. These are unusual circumstances. There's actually a lockdown. There is a liquidity dry up that's happening at a retail level as well. So for me, that makes sense. But I think there was a lot of misinterpretation going around as well, because I saw some leading newspapers also talking about, and even on Twitter, I saw people asking questions on, I remember one question being, my interest has already been deducted from my account. Can I please get it back?
Questions were, A, is this a kind of a waiver or a deferment? And then another thing that was kind of, going around was that, is it like a blanket deferment, or do banks have their discretion? And I think when you read the detailed notice that RBI came up with, which basically defines the modalities for the scheduled commercial banks, a lot of things get cleared up there, right? That A, this is not a waiver, this is a deferment. So if, say, you have 20 EMIs left, you'll still be paying 20 EMIs. There'll just be a 3-month gap in between. And
it's a deferment, right?
Yeah.
That's what it is.
And to add on, I mean, what I did not like a lot was that for the 3-month deferment, the accrued interest would still be liable, which kind of, I think, kind of goes against the point of doing this. And the third thing which I found a bit odd was that, I think, I was discussing it yesterday when the announcement came in, that so right now, the RBI has given permission to grant a moratorium to the banks. So when you say permission to grant, it's not a mandate. It's basically just a recommendation or an advisory. And then individual banks are supposed to come out with their own policies on how to go with it. I mean, but I'm wondering, say if I am a borrower and say I have an EMI which is due on, 1st of April, and I'm under financial distress. Let's say I was a salaried person. I lost my job due to the COVID-19 outbreak. Am I now, frankly, supposed to go to the bank and, submit documents trying to prove how I am financially distressed because of coronavirus, so that, some bank level guy actually approves my application? Or, I mean, what's going to happen is that I'm just going to default. After 3 months, I'm going to give the explanation why I defaulted. And if I'm lucky, my explanation would work and I would have to just pay the accrued interest. And if I'm unlucky, then I'm defaulting.
That's how I take it as well. But I'm still, I'm just a little bit positive. Like, the two things, right? I mean, one is, typically, I think if you don't pay your interest for 3 months, it gets qualified as a non-performing asset for the banks, right? So that won't happen.
That won't happen.
So banks sort of maintain their positioning. And the second is, I think, credit score of a person who sort of, that is another big thing, like, stays intact. I think I'm correct. If they're not paying for 3 months, your credit score will still
be it won't be affected.
But that will again depend on whether you're qualified or not. So it is a logistical challenge, but I'm a little bit of an optimist in the sense that I think most people who have been affected or have really genuinely struggled to pay up their interest payments, I think will, over time, it might not be a quick thing, but we will get that, it's ultimately they have to pay one way or the other. So that money will go eventually. It's just that you'll defer it to a time. And I think there's a little bit more clarity that's required, because I think these things just are not easy to understand for a lot of retail folks.
I mean, for me, it would have been a real winner or a real moratorium if, say, the government would have said that, look, for 3 months, there won't be any EMI demand, and this amount would be backstopped by the government, period. That just simplifies it so much, right? I mean, at this stage, now you have to look at it on a case-by-case basis, whether this guy qualifies and whether this guy doesn't qualify, right? And if the government really wants to, kind of help, I think that would have been a more sensible way to do it. What was impressive was that the chairman of SBI just went ahead and said exactly that. I mean, he did say that it's not a kind of a backstop, but he did say that all term loan EMIs would be just stopped. So you don't have to come into the bank, because who can go to the bank right now? I mean, you can't just step out of your house and go to your branch, I mean, the branches are underserved. There are not that many people out there. So
I think a lot of people, they have their own bank accounts with the same, their lenders in terms of whenever they've picked up the loans as well. A lot of them have that auto deduction, right, already going on.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Right. So it's only that auto deduction will fail only if the amount in your balance is below the minimum required, right?
Correct.
Otherwise, it will just keep going until there's a call to action is for the retailer here.
Onus is on the borrower, which I think just kind of defeats the purpose to a certain extent. Overall, it's still, I think, better than what I kind of was anticipating. And but you know, it's kind of very, very fascinating how globally this has become such a as you said in the beginning, right? I mean, it's no longer a question of providing support to spike up demand, because there won't be any demand for some time.
Yeah.
So like even in the US, Federal Reserve pretty much gave a blank check, right?
Yeah.
ECB gave a blank check. Even in RBI, when it, I mean, you know, that was a very, I think, positive thing that the governor said in the end, that you know, we'll do whatever it takes. So you know, this is not a strategy which is frozen. It's a moving plan, and as and when circumstances change, we'll be happy to, you know, kind of provide more support and to the system, which I think kind of just shows how much affected the financial systems have been globally. But you know, it's funny that, you know, I was you know, I kind of enjoy reading that guy Taleb, right, who wrote Black Swan. So I'm reading another of his books called Fooled by Randomness, and that, I mean, that this paragraph I was reading today, which was very, very interesting. It was like that that, you know, whenever you hear, oh, how can this happen, it has never happened before, you know, the assumption here is that the worst has already happened in the past. Which I found very, very, very relatable to what's happening right now. That this is like a singular black swan event, which nobody could have predicted.
Yeah.
And so,
that's funny.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, but it's a very cynical way of looking, right? I mean, why do you think the worst has already happened? Worst can happen tomorrow. I mean, I think it's difficult to, you know, kind of. It's not a very realistic strategy to operate on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, and I remember, like, I read an interesting line in one of in The Economist. And for me, it's like the last time we experienced some kind of recession was probably 2008-09.
That's when we were entering the job market.
Like at that time, I don't think I'd ever worked in capital markets, or I didn't have that much of an understanding about finance and economics. And this time, like, I mean, 12 years down the line, I'm having a closer look at all this, because I understand what's happening a lot better.
Yeah.
And I read this line in The Economist, and they said, like, in 08, like, when a big country like US sneezes, everyone catches a cold.
Right.
But in this case, the whole world is coughing.
Right.
So it's just so much more worse, it appears like. That's the thing, right? I mean, everyone is sort of in the same boat, and it's such a global impact, like it will just be so difficult and so different to come out of it. Let's see how it goes. I mean, the India bent obviously is like, I'm not very comfortable when people sort of compare on RBI needs to do more because US is there, the Fed has done XYZ. Like, you can't compare like that. I mean, they have like four different, I mean, they have the dollar there. I mean, like, listen, you can't do that in India. Like, there's so many nuances. You can't do it. Like, when, you know, I see a lot of people making that loose argument about, we're not doing enough, we're doing this, and just comparing. You can't compare like that. For me, that has been something that I've been exposed to so much. And it's been that, like, mainstream news media as well. Like, you just can't compare. Like, they're fundamentally not comparable.
I mean, we are not also fundamentally comparable to China. So, I mean, that also kind of fails the test. Oh, no, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think the main, for instance, if you are at this is not the moment to be a trader. This is the time to be an investor, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at things on a day-to-day, minute-by-minute basis, I think it's difficult to operate, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember I was like looking at this many of these websites, right, which are keeping a global count of how many affected cases and how many deaths. If you look at it on a minute by minute basis, it's very difficult to operate. So I stopped doing that, because I mean, it doesn't matter, the daily losses are if the daily losses are kept capped long term, it is a decent strategy to follow. You know, it's the same thing, right? For instance, if you're an active trader or an investor, and you're PNL positive all throughout, but say you get one dramatically big loss which wipes out your entire portfolio, there's no point of doing that, right? So the idea here is to right now kind of hedge your losses rather than anything else. So from that standpoint, I think within the Indian context, we have to kind of, you know, admit a few things. Number one, we don't have a comparable healthcare system. We really don't have we don't have that infrastructure in place. So the only way to kind of, you know, stop this is by overcompensating. You know, that's why this entire, physical restrictions and kind of a hard lockdown was so essential. And I'm happy that that happened without waiting for, like, if you compare it to the US, in the US, there's still no lockdown, you know?
Yeah,
in the US, there are some states where still they are operating business as usual, which I think can backfire. I mean, obviously, US has many more ventilators. They have many more ICU units than in India. Maybe that's the reason why there is a bit of complacency there. But here, I think from that standpoint, I feel, you know, that entire action of overreacting is a better strategy to go, because the loss can be just too big if you don't do that. And yeah, I mean, besides that, I mean, obviously we are financially constrained, you know, we don't have that kind of resources that US would have. Even US is struggling right now. So yeah. I think it's you know, what's the last thing I feel that, you know, the guys like us who are, you know, in the comfort of our homes, and, you know, we shouldn't complain. there are people, you know, who are in much more difficult circumstances at this stage. You know, who are kind of stuck between cities and villages and who are stuck on the road. So, I mean, it's, I think, important for the narrative to stay optimistic and positive in general.
That's obviously, you know,
I mean, one can do all the analysis after. There will be a lot of time to analyze this.
Already started. I mean, there is just, in hindsight, like, the hindsight is a beautiful tool, right? In hindsight, it's easy to call what is right, what is wrong.
Yeah.
But it's obviously, like, we are not there in terms of how, as a nation, where we can take care of everyone. There is obviously, this lockdown comes at massive cost to, you know, some of the lower on the economic pyramid, and we obviously need to act quickly to sort of take care. And it's happening, but it's just not easy. Like, the intent is there, but it's the act of exercising it. It's a massive administrative challenge. I mean, people struggle to, run a company of 5-10 people. I mean, this is 1.3 billion people that have to be managed, right?
Yeah.
It's not easy.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, there was a lot of discussion going on testing, right? How there's a need for more testing. For some time, I was like, that's, you know, that makes sense. You know, you should do more testing so that you have more data. If you have more data, you know how big the problem is and you solve it accordingly. And then, you know, I was reading something by, it was a developing markets public health professional. I forgot the name. And his argument was that, look, if your behavior is not changing, subject to the result of testing, better not to put your resources in testing. I.e., for instance, if you are positive, is that you self-quarantine. And if the solution that you are negative is also that you're going to self-quarantine. So, you know, your behavior is neutral to the outcome of the test, then better to not focus on the testing part, better to focus on the behavior part. And I think he was kind of referring to, you know, when the HIV outbreak started in India, and when the polio outbreak started before that, because here just the sheer number of people is so huge that those, you know, initial restrictions and controls play a much larger role than actually, because, you know, if community infection happens and if a lot of people start going to the hospitals, then the game is already over. So the idea is to avoid that before anything else comes up. So, I mean, I kind of am getting a lot of tremendous amount of respect lately for, you know, even for administration, to be fair, that, you know, it's easier said than done. As you said, managing a company of 5 people or 10 people or 15 people is one thing, and looking at 1.3 billion people is another thing. There'll always be, you know, glitches and issues, but I think things have been commendable from that perspective so far.
Yeah, and, like, the objective now should be, like, the next time something like this happens, we learn from our lessons, and we know we learn and sort of are more prepared. Like, this is unprecedented, like, people use the word loosely, but this is literally unprecedented. I mean, shutting down a country is ridiculously bizarre. Like, I don't think hopefully we'll never see this in our lifetimes, but it's nothing like this.
That goes against what Mr. Taleb said. Why do you think the worst is over?
I'm hoping that
we're
not gonna
see it. Yeah. But I mean, from the perspective of, looking at things on the bright side, I think, you know, this entire narrative of globalization, and I mean, obviously globalization had a role to play in terms of making this because of air travel, right? I mean, air travel is easier than it ever was. The world is interconnected. That's why a virus kind of spread all over the world so quickly. But I think that argument goes both ways, right? I mean, if tomorrow there's a fix to this problem, that will also spread at lightning speed.
Correct.
So I'm fairly optimistic on that front. And I think, the good thing is that everyone is taking it seriously, at least in India, and yeah. I hope globally also. I mean, wherever, whichever part of the world where it's not being taken very seriously, people start taking it more seriously, because you know, you want to kind of, you know, get out of it as soon as possible rather than wait, because after that time has passed, then there's a different set of problems then which comes out.
Yeah. Humanitarian side as well, and what do you think about the equity markets, because that has been fascinating in the last 10-12 days. The volatility and people calling bottoms every other day and then sometimes being wrong. And I mean, like you said, like, it's for us, like, I mean, the way I look at it is just you know, if you're an optimist, if you think that you know, we come out of it, which I'm pretty certain I will, and you have to be extremely cynical to think that world is coming to an end, then it is. You have a lot of things available at massive discounts, right? I mean, that's how I'm looking at it.
I mean, yeah, you're right. The thing is that, and we kind of wrote a bit on this as well, that on the equity markets, it's probably, it's time to look at opportunities more like a lender rather than as an equity investor. I'm sure there are quality names out there. You know, which have strong balance sheets, which have you know, solid margins, which have cash on their books, which are not very which have low debt, which are not working capital constrained, or even if they have kind of painful working capital cycles, they have sufficient cash on their books to make sure that they can deal with that situation in case liquidity evaporates. I think those names are still interesting, you know, and they are probably available cheaper than ever before. I think, you know, that entire narrative of buy the dip, that doesn't really work, because no one knows what the dip is. So I mean, I think one shouldn't kind of, you know, think too much about it. I mean, probably it's a slightly risk-off environment. So better to go for solid, big balance sheet, robust, financial-oriented businesses, rather than go for, you know, something very, very experimental and high growth, which might not be the most diversified at this stage. Because, I mean, I kind of look at it that if you're looking at a company, say, to invest in, you have to consider, okay, if suppose for the next 3 to 4 quarters, if demand evaporates, will this be a sustainable business? So if I think the answer to that is yes, that means it's a fundamentally solid business. Yeah, and if it's available at the right price, go for it.
Yeah, and yeah, and I mean, you know, like right now, like everything is down 20, 25, 30, 35, some 50% down. Like, so I mean, what has changed? I mean, we've got to assess what has changed in the last 2 weeks or 3 weeks for it to warrant such a downswing, right? And if you think that, does it ever come back to what the outlook looked like 2 weeks back? If the answer to that is yes, then everything is available at discount, right? And I certainly think that, you know, the realization has been pushed out, the cash flow generation, the net income realization, the dividends, or whatever might be pushed out a little bit, but they will always come back. They have to come back, and that sort of, again, this is not your, I don't know if the worst is behind us or yet to come. I don't know about that, but I still think that...
I think it's more it's probably more a survivor issue, right? Rather than whether things will normalize. I mean, it's basically, if things are not normal for too long, how many of the companies would actually stay around? And the idea is to kind of make sure that you bet on those opportunities which will stay around. But I mean, because I'm sure that as soon as normalcy comes back or stability or uncertainty reduces, I mean, then demand will spike and, you know, things will kind of spike on their own. But I mean, at the end of the day, like, how much losses can these companies take? That is something which one can, you know, assess, then I think it's a great time to buy. I mean, I think there are a lot of people who made a lot of money betting during 2008, 2009. I'm sure there'll be a lot of people who'll make a lot of money now. I mean, what were you reading about? That was a Bill Ackman, right? He did a $27 million trade. He made $2.7 billion out of it. And I mean, obviously, that's something that not everyone can crack, because it's kind of a short-term trading call. But I mean, there are always, you know, opportunities and angles to look at. Because let's face it, I mean, in the Indian equities, we were trading consistently at 28, 29 times earnings for the last, I would say, 18 months. I mean, you were selling me that. I remember that some friend of yours in emerging markets equity says that India is just too expensive. So, yeah, I think...
Yeah, that notion has been there for a while, that India trades with a massive premium.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, this is kind of a correction. I mean, nobody actually thought that this correction or whatever. I mean, everybody said that these are priced in. It's very expensive. You know, there will be a recession. Like in US, there's been a narrative, there'll be a recession soon. I think everybody got very stumped about, oh my God, how is this a cause of the recession? But yeah. Recession is a recession, right? Can't really, yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, this is a public health disaster, which has financial and economic impacts. It's not the other way around. So one has to kind of, if, as soon as the public health disaster part gets checked, the other things are going to correct themselves.
Yeah, and you got to be prepared that they don't lead to another public health, right? I mean, they're intricately linked, right? So obviously focus is always going to be health and public health, and that is obviously priority one for everyone. But in the process, you know, you've got to also take care of the financial markets, and you've got to take care of what the economy as such is, the way it's behaving, because that also has comes at, you know, that also has a negative impact. A poorly functioning economy also impacts public health and related nuances. So it's a difficult balance to maintain, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the one thing that I would really like, especially in India, for the government to pick up from this once it's over is increase your spending in healthcare. I mean, we are at less than 3% of GDP. We can't continue to do like that. I mean, healthcare is something that has to be a priority focus area. And, I don't think like you can leave the entire onus of this on the private sector. If you want cheap healthcare, you need to build it. So I think that is something I hope
they
take from this. Not very optimistic about it. Obviously, as soon as the problem disappears, then people move on. Too much sense, that the same sense of resilience which we often admire about human beings, I think also is a big problem, that people just like move on very quickly. They don't even think about it after some
years. And, universal healthcare sort of is again a very highly debated topic in the US as well. I mean this should drop, perhaps be end all the arguments which oppose it. I genuinely personally believe universal healthcare is for every person across country. So maybe there is hopefully some hope there.
And it is already kind of, bringing ideas like universal basic income to mainstream. I mean, in India also, you're getting that so-called helicopter money. In US, that's also happening. Universal basic income has been, especially, with the rise of automation, with the rise of AI, everybody suspects that there'll be a lot of job losses unless you upskill yourself. So, it's not a bad idea to actually put some sort of a paycheck. I mean, it's a fairly socialist kind of an argument. I get it. I think the world, is moving so fast with technology backing it that, that just de facto became one of the policy solutions after the COVID-19 outbreak. So I'm hoping that like universal basic income is getting such mainstream resonance, universal healthcare also gets some love. Cool. Sharad, I think this was fun.
I'm glad we did this off schedule before our next season interim episode, and
let's see how long the thing lasts. We might do another episode.
who knows
Well, no, as I said earlier, guys, everyone, feel free to, drop in your comments, your feedback on our podcast. If you have any questions on recent financial and economic developments, feel free to reach out. We will definitely put our details in the description. And stay healthy, stay safe, take care of yourself. And this is Nikhil Arora.
Fish are a two plan.
Signing off.